Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Pensions Experts Fortnightly Podcast. This week, we join you with a renewed sense of purpose and optimism, having survived 6 months of coronavirus, 4 months of lockdown, and a full 18 hours in the local on Saturday. It's doubtful whether anything can stop us at this point, though if any words are slurred during this recording, it's only because Wetherspoons was offering unmentionably cheap scotch for breakfast. So this week, we take another look at the insolvency bill, which received royal assent shortly after we last went to air. And we ask whether, despite the industry's best attempts to change it, it retains the power to damage defined benefit schemes. Thereafter, we'll discuss the pension schemes bill, on which the government recently suffered no less than 4 defeats in the House of Lords. So we'll ask the Lords on what of why not and why of oh why. Finally, the Make My Money Matter campaign, aimed at shifting some £3 trillion of pension pots into sustainable investments, launched last week. Our guests will give their prognosis while studiously avoiding any pension-related puns on the films of Richard Curtis. My name is Benjamin Mercer. I'm a reporter at Pensions Expert, and I'm joined today by Tiffany Tang, LGPS and DB Policy Lead at the Pensions and Lifetime Savings Association, and Jeremy Goodwin, partner at law firm Evershed Sutherland. Thank you both very much for joining me. First, insolvency then. There were a number of amendments tabled to the bill, especially concerning its provisions for a company moratorium and the question of super priority status being given to some creditors but not others. I know there were some changes made to the bill, though I understand some of the more meaningful amendments were not passed in the end. Could you explain to us what the problems were with it? I know it's quite a broad question, but specifically concerning the moratorium and worries about super priority. Then maybe we can discuss whether those concerns were adequately addressed in the process.
Our understanding of it is that essentially there were two key problems with these emergency measures that the government was trying to put through, which the PLSA, first of all, we have to say that we absolutely understand the government was caught between a rock and a hard place. You know, that these are unprecedented times. And so these emergency measures were the intent behind them were absolutely the right thing to do. But pensions became sort of an afterthought, or not even a thought during the construction process of these emergency proposals. And one of the things that came out of it was that the moratorium really would, it was meant to set aside 40 working days in which companies and employers could have a bit of breathing space from creditors. And what that ended up doing is that had the bill gone through in its initial stages and in the way that it was drafted, it really would have caused problems for how pensions are ranked, that they would have been pushed further down the queue, and that there would have been a perception that really banks and lenders were given precedence essentially in an insolvency situation. So essentially what that means for the day-to-day is that pensions would be sort of sacrificed, because by the time companies were in a situation where pensions could then enter into talks again for negotiation for restructuring, in all likelihood, the assets will all be gone, because pensions were lower down the rank in what they could ask for. And what that did in practice was freeze out trustees from pension schemes, as well as the PPF, who acts as the trustees as well to negotiate on behalf of the schemes. It froze them out from a seat at the table. So that's number one. And then in doing that, that would have in all likelihood caused a widening deficit in which the remaining solvent companies would have to deal with. And what that translates to into practice is that the levy that a lot of companies that companies have to pay every year, the annual levy to the PPF, would in most cases have risen. So for those two reasons, really, it would have really gone against what the government was trying to achieve to begin with, which was to protect solvent companies. And number two, the PPF would have been frozen out, and DB schemes would have been frozen out of discussions for negotiations, and pensions would have been sacrificed. So in a nutshell, that's what we're looking for in terms of trying to combat against negative consequences, unintended as they were, for pension schemes.
Correct me if I'm wrong, of course. I mean, the PLSA was one of those calling for a change in the wording of the bill. I know that there were some changes made. Were your concerns broadly addressed? And is it possible that they could all have been addressed anyway, given that the purpose of the bill arguably just didn't allow for it?
Absolutely. The PLSA is actually quite proud that we were one of the leading voices in calling for this change. And again, as I said in the very beginning, we understand the government was caught between a rock and a hard place, that these emergency proposals for companies to give them a bit of breathing space needed to happen. But we absolutely did need to flag, as the PLSA and the other voices in the industry, about the urgent need to ensure that pensions were cited in the bill. So in terms of your question of, you know, did we get what we wanted? I think the answer to that question is absolutely we were able to ensure the situation is undoubtedly more favorable now to pension schemes than how it would have been originally had the original drafts gone through. In terms of would we like to have seen the amendments go further? I think in policymaking there's always a push and pull, and I think that we were able to secure the fact that pensions, trustees of pension schemes, of DB pension schemes and the PPF do now have, they've been ensured a seat at the table, which they didn't have before.
Jeremy, do you have a take just more broadly on the insolvency bill itself? I mean, concerns, worries or prognoses?
I think what's the thing most interesting is when you look at the Corporate Insolvency Act, it's all about introducing that rescue culture into the insolvency landscape in the UK. Obviously came about as a result of much lobbying by insolvency experts. And so things like the moratorium that we've just been talking about was very, very much designed to try and help businesses. You know, it was pushed through Parliament in a very, very short amount of time to try to help businesses at this very difficult time without them needing to become insolvent. And obviously when you look at that, then, and I know we're going to touch on the pension schemes bill shortly, there are some real issues in relation to the criminal offences provisions under the Pension Schemes Bill, which really go against the rescue culture in many ways. And so I think it's really that relationship which is most interesting. So I think you've got the Corporate Insolvency Act obviously pushed through Parliament in very short order, and you know, largely because of the PLSA's sensible lobbying, the pensions angle finally being taken into account there, which is great. But it still seems like, in relation to the way that legislation is being made, you've got the left hand and the right hand not really talking to each other by the result of the Corporate Insolvency Act. They're really looking at that rescue culture not really being taken into account then when you're looking at the pension schemes bill.
Brilliant. Well, that sounds like you've provided my segue for me, because obviously we are now moving on to the pension schemes bill. It's been around longer than I have, it seems. the government has obviously recently lost votes on four amendments. It's got potential implications both for the dashboards and also the regulator and also open DB schemes. But Jeremy, I know that you had a particular, a slightly more appropriate and interesting segue perhaps than that for me. So I wonder if you wanted to begin us with exploring a little bit more in that area.
Okay, so if I perhaps just say something in relation to the criminal offences side of things. So I think, you know, there's two offences which are built into the pension schemes bill. So the first, you know, broadly designed around activity, which is avoiding Section 75 debts. And the second one, it's really the second one that we should be most excited about, which is conduct which puts at risk accrued pension schemes benefits. And that's anything which an act which could have a detrimental likelihood on someone getting their accrued benefits, and where you ought to have known about that at the time. And in terms of the persons that could be liable in relation to one of these criminal offences, it's as broad as any person. So it picks up advisors, it picks up company directors. You know, it is extremely broad. And so I think really it's with that, when you're then thinking about the kinds of activities which may be being carried out, think about the context of the Corporate Insolvency Act, looking at what could be done in relation to extending further credit, where that credit is secured, and through extending that secured credit, you're then making it less likely that the unsecured pensions creditor ends up getting their monies. And by extending that secured credit, for example, to a failing company, are you doing something which means that you could then actually be seen to be putting the accrued benefits under the pension scheme in a worse place and therefore potentially subject to a criminal offence? So it's that kind of activity, the unintended consequences, as we were just hearing about in relation to the Insolvency Act. It just really feels like those unintended consequences in relation to the breadth of the criminal offences haven't really been thought about.
Sure. Tiffany, did you have a take on this particular area?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is something the PLSA has been really focused on in our lobbying efforts with the pension schemes. Well, and I absolutely agree with Jeremy that there is too much broadness in the way that the criminal offences aspects of the proposals are applied. And it really could apply, as Jeremy said, it could apply to anyone involved with schemes such as trustees, banks, lending to employers, insurers, investment counterparties. And, you know, really, while we absolutely support the need to give TPR more bite, basically, more sharpness to their bite, I think there really needs to be more clarity because of the potential unintended consequences, as Jeremy says, about, you know, it really could have unintended consequences for the day-to-day running of pension schemes. It could stifle legitimate corporate activity, as was alluded to, and really create unnecessary costs. And I think it is about being specific. It's just too broad, the language at the moment. And we do urge the government to really think about being more specific in its language so that it does do what it's intended to do, which is to catch bad behavior, to deter bad behavior, and to make sure that kind of malicious intent is punished appropriately. But rather, the way that it's currently phrased, it really does put in danger the way, you know, the day-to-day running of schemes, which we really want to try and avoid. That sort of, we don't want to clog up the system with unintended consequences, is the phrase of the day, I suppose.
That's certainly the impression I get. I mean, I did a story, actually, it was on the insolvency bill a little while ago, and pretty much everyone I spoke to in relation to that story used the word unintended at least twice. so that bodes well. I mean, it was pointed out to me at the time in relation to the insolvency bill that actually the pension schemes bill, if worded in the correct way and passed with relative haste, might provide clarity and maybe restore some protections which were arguably lost in the passage of the insolvency bill. I mean, am I right in thinking from what we've said so far that's a potentiality, but the pension schemes bill as it stands is not sufficient to provide those protections? Would that be a fair passing of what's just been said? Jeremy, if you wanted to comment on that.
So I'm not sure that's right. I think, you know, from a pension schemes perspective, I think there are a number of significant protections which have been built in there. I think it's actually more when you look at it from a restructuring angle and say from a corporate perspective as to whether the unintended consequence of the pension schemes bill is to make restructuring harder and to really undermine that rescue culture which we were talking about in relation to the Insolvency Act. You know, when you look at the wider provisions of the pension schemes bill, we've got a lot more there in relation to contribution notices and when they can be used. We've got more there in relation to a very sensible extension, for example, to notifiable events. So there's quite a lot in the pension schemes bill, which is genuinely very helpful for pension schemes and the protections which they can have.
In that case, I think we'll move on to the final topic of the day, which is the Make My Money Matter campaign. I'm going to re-emphasize the need to avoid Richard Curtis puns because he's punching the Make My Money Matter campaign, and I've seen some terrible ones, and I may even have indulged in some myself. So we will not be doing four pension pots and an unethical tobacco investment. But the goal of the campaign is, of course, to move some, I think it's about £3 trillion worth of pension pots into more sustainable investments. And I know, Jeremy, I think we've spoken previously on this subject before about what currently is the law around making what you could call non-financial ethical investments. I wonder if you could set those out for us. I know that the Law Commission has its two tests, doesn't it, when it comes to making these sorts of investments?
Yes, I think, I mean, the key thing is if you can look at something and see from a financial perspective that it's at least as good as you could achieve through taking into account just purely financial factors, then that's fine. You can then invest in something, you know, matters which then take into account ESG type factors. So to make sure it comes back to something which you can see as being financially positive. Then in relation to the other situation, so something where you can't look at something from a financial perspective is then when you're making sure you've maybe carried out a survey or membership and you're then really comfortable that it is what the members are wanting to achieve. So in that situation, you could then invest in something which is not necessarily financially beneficial, but only in a circumstance where you really understand that that's actually what the members are asking for.
Brilliant. And Tiffany, because obviously with your knowledge of both LGPS and sort of defined benefit policy areas, I mean, I imagine that this falls quite nicely into concerns that will be present for both. I mean, we've covered some ethically questionable LGPS investments before, but these are significantly sized pension pots as well. I mean, it's asking you to project quite far into the future, I suppose. But I mean, would you imagine this kind of campaign to raise public awareness, to get members much more involved in the ethical and investment decisions of their schemes, would be successful?
Oh, absolutely. I think the PLC definitely agrees with the campaign that we'd love to see an increase in savers' understanding of how their pension money is invested. And I just to have my LGPS hat on, I feel like it's important to raise their flag and say that LGPS has been thinking about these issues for quite a long time. And I think they our members would be cross with me if I didn't say that actually that there are a lot of lessons that the private sector is now learning from the public sector in terms of responsible investing and an ESG focus. So yes, It's ESG is one of the top priorities for the PLSA, and it's I think that the intent behind the campaign is something that we're keen to see feed into how that aligns with our goals as well, and bringing a greater spotlight onto ESG and climate change disclosure.
And Jeremy, just one more on this topic, if I may. I mean, obviously we mentioned that one of the Law Commission's tests is that these decisions must be made, and trustees must be able to show in some form that the decisions around ethical investments are made in line with what they perceive members' interests and also desires to be. And I spoke with Richard Curtis and the CEO of Make My Money Matter a few days ago, last week, in fact, I think it was. And they said they would really like to see much more by way of a much stricter requirement to account for members' views and interests. Is there scope in the law as it stands to have some form of, it's fairly unclear at the moment as to exactly what constitutes taking into account members' interests. Is there scope in the law to give clarity to that, or is that something that really needs legislative change to accomplish?
I think we'd want to see legislative change to accomplish that. I think there are obviously, you know, huge issues in relation to that. So in terms of what members want, you know, if you look at a normal pension scheme with the number of members you'd have in relation to one of those schemes, you know, to actually try and gauge, you know, one particular view which, you know, all the members want, you know, there are some clear, real practical issues in relation to that. So going back to what we've talked about before, so if the law as it currently stands is very clear that, you know, in the vast majority of cases, you're going to be wanting to go back to what are members' best financial interests. And so you go back to the money side. Now, clearly, when you're looking over the long term, taking into account climate change related risks, you can often identify that financial benefit because it does better manage risks over the long term. But hanging that on a survey of members or trying to gauge what all the members want, that there are some real practical issues there which you can see arising.
Yeah, and Tiffany, just one more for you as well, if I may. I mean, I was writing, I think, yesterday on the Environment Agency Pension Fund, which is known quite widely as one of the leading funds when it comes to sustainable investments, ESG, and all the rest. They're quite keen on they're taking it on their own account to go and survey members, poll members, and to get them much more involved in investments. They've also signed up to the Make My Money Matter campaign. I think they're amongst the first signatories. I mean, in your opinion, are LGPS funds in particular quite aware of the need to poll their members? Is this something that they're doing, as it were, on their own back already? Or is there still some work that needs to be done to get members more involved?
It's a really, really great question. And as I flagged the LGPS, this is a huge area of work for them. And we're working really closely with different stakeholders in the public sector right now to look at these questions about how members are communicated, about best practice. And in fact, right now, we're working together with the Scheme Advisory Board for England and Wales in making sure that the guidance is updated on responsible investing and ESG. And that is looking at how to better communicate with members at the moment. And I think that member comms is high on the list for the LGPS, and this is definitely one of the issues there for them.
Perfect.
It's worthwhile mentioning also, just to pick up a theme from what we had before, so you've got all the provisions in the pension schemes bill as well, looking at all the climate change provisions, and similarly the DWP consultation in relation to the TCFD disclosures, which again will all go to that same element of much more transparency in relation to what pension schemes are doing, and probably much more into the member communications in relation to ESG matters.
Great. In which case, that brings us finally to our Always a Pensions Angle segment. Jeremy, I think you've got one for us for this, and I think it's the kind of one where I have to declare an interest, as when I'm not locked down in Bedford, I live on a boat, and this is nautically themed.
Very good. So I think it's the interesting story of the Chatham Chest. So this is from the 16th century and went back to seamen who were out at sea, and if they had an injury at sea and come back, and they could have a pension provided for them. And there was actually a physical chest, which still exists, it's at Chatham Dockyard now, I believe, where seamen, while they were able and out at sea, would come and put a particular amount of money into the chest, and that chest would then be used in the future then to fund the pensions for those that have been disabled while at sea. Of course, one of the issues that they had in relation to it, particularly when you went through wars, etc., was that there were many more people wanting to take money out of the pot than wanting to put money into the pot. And so what then eventually happened is that the government recognised there was a clear deficit in terms of the monies that were left in the chest. And so the government ended up stepping into the situation to then top up the funds going into the pension scheme. So it's one of the very, very first examples of an issue in relation to an underfunded pension scheme having huge issues, and then the government lifeboat coming in then to try and save the Chatham Chest.
Gives a new meaning to the phrase to bail out, doesn't it?
exactly right.
Perfect. In which case, I think that brings us nicely to a close. Thank you, Jeremy, and thank you, Tiffany, for joining us. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Thank you for listening, and we will see you then.
1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
ACAST powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.